One of our other writers, Christopher Stevens, your subject, Kenneth Williams, exposed himself massively in his published diaries, shall we say. And so you, in fact, had to contend with someone who had possibly put out too much information about himself to the detriment of his reputation, I think, because anyone who's read those diaries might not like him terribly much. So you, Christopher, kind of had to rehabilitate him from the car wreck of his own words, didn't you?
That's very true. And it was very much the starting point of the biography as well, that there are 5 million words in Kenneth Williams' archive, all of which were written when he was on his own. And as you get to know him, the first thing you realise is that he hated being on his own. He was an extrovert who needed to be with people and who was exhausted by being with people because he performed constantly when he was in company. And so when he was alone, he was at a double disadvantage. He was lonely and he was tired, which is never the best circumstance to be writing a critique of oneself. When I decided that I wanted to tackle the biography, I wrote to one of Kenneth's closest friends, Nicholas Parsons, who had not only been his chairman on Just a Minute for 20 years before Kenneth died, but had known Kenneth since the late 1940s when they were on stage together in Repertory Theatre. And I asked Nicholas why he felt Kenneth had been so harsh about himself and yet had been such an exuberant and lovable performer, because I simply couldn't make these two things come together. You've got this heroically amusing, funny personality that we all know from the Carry On films where he's scripted, but also from the radio performances, the many panel games and the chat shows when he's completely off the cuff, and he is clearly effortlessly funny in any setting. Peter Cook used to say that Kenneth Williams could be the funniest man alive if only he would work a little bit harder. And on the other side, you have this reputation which has, as Melissa says, come up since his death, that he was bitter, sarcastic, hateful, that he had no patience with anybody, and that, frankly, most of the time he wished he was dead. And there was a strong suggestion that he had, in fact, killed himself. How do you fit those two things together? How is that possible? That manic voice that you hear on Round the Horn, how can it go away and simply despise itself? That doesn't seem possible. And I asked Nicholas about this. I said, does that make any sense to you? Was he actually like this behind the scenes? And Nicholas said, well, he could be very spiteful backstage, but that was all part of the performance. However, when you really saw him come alive was when the lights went down and the audience started to applaud and we all walked out on stage, and Kenneth would always be the last one to go out. He'd milk it. And as he went out, he'd stick his backside out and he'd walk very uncomfortably as though he had piles, and the audience would be howling with laughter before he'd opened his mouth, before he'd sat down. And from then on, the performance would be simply uncontrollable. There would be partial stripteases during other people's lines. You know, he would be constantly getting the attention by tearing his clothes off, by putting his legs up on the table or up on other people, by throwing himself into Clement Troy's lap and nibbling his ear. And Nicholas said, think about the intensity of performing like that and the adrenaline rush that it must have caused. And then think about going back to a solitary life where you're not married. Kenneth never was married, never had a partner with whom he lived, and no children. It's much easier, as Nicholas pointed out, to go back to a family, and if you've had a bad performance or you're stressed out, you can talk it through, or you can do something completely different and allow yourself to be distracted by your family. Kenneth never had that. What he had instead was a diary, and that's like a magnifying glass for emotions. I don't think he was self-aware enough to be able to deliberately step away from the negative emotions, to identify that he was feeling low and to try and force himself into an upbeat mood. He was very much actually at the victim of, at the mercy of his moods, and so were all his friends. Stanley Baxter, who was probably Kenneth's closest friend throughout his entire career, they met in Singapore just after the war in Army Entertainment Services. And Stanley, who'd never talked about Kenneth before, who loved Kenneth very dearly, and did not want ever to say anything that could be construed as a criticism, so had never said anything, finally trusted me enough to talk to me. And one of the things he told me was that when he went to pick Kenneth up to take him out to dinner, two things could happen. He could come down the stairs with a mischievous glint in his eye and throw himself into the passenger seat and say, "Do you know what you said to me exactly this day, September the 16th, 23 years ago, do you know?" And Stanley said, "Well, I'd always say, my memory's not that good, Kenneth." And Kenneth said, "Well, I'll tell you, it's all in my diary." Or he could come down the stairs with his collar turned up, because he had an idea that if he turned up his collar, nobody would recognise him. And he'd get into the car and he'd say nothing. And Stanley would say, "How are you?" And Kenneth would say, "Well, dear, we're all waiting for death, aren't we?" He didn't seem able to be able to control which of those personalities was on display. And I think we have judged him very much since his death on the lows. We didn't want him to be so unhappy. It hurts us to think that he was so miserable. And I know a lot of his friends have said to me, "I wish I'd understood how bitterly unhappy he was in those last years, because I would have done more to be with him." At the same time, he was almost impossible to be with in his last years, and I do know that I hurried away from him if I could. Barbara Windsor gets very tearful when she thinks that the last time she met him, she was in the street and she heard his voice, and she says, "My first thought was, shit." And then having to speak to him, and then getting away as quickly as she could with a promise that they'd meet up soon. And of course they didn't. On the other hand, he wasn't always the most lovable person anyway. Some of his friends suffered very much if they made him envious or if they somehow crashed his limelight. Fenella Fielding, who performed with him in Carry On Screaming, which I think is the funniest of all the Carry On films, and Fenella is a wonderfully witty and feisty person, she told me that they were the hit of the West End in 1960. It was the biggest show on the West End, written by Peter Cook and Harold Pinter. There's a combination. It was called Pieces of Eight. It was a review in which they took turns to come on and do sketches. And Fenella was not well known then. She didn't do a lot of radio work. She was just coming up. And she was a revelation to the critics, who adored her. And after they did the pre-West End run-in in Brighton, she got a fantastic review in the Argus, which Kenneth proceeded to bring into the theatre the next day and follow her round backstage, loudly reading out lines from it. He was furious. He made her suffer all day by sarcastically repeating and parroting these words of praise. And finally, backing her into a corner with the newspaper rolled up in his hand and threatening her with it and saying, "Do you know what happens to people who trade on reputations like this?" She was quite physically scared of him. It got worse. He paid some of the chorus boys to go and stand outside her dressing room window and talk about what a bitch she was. Fenella took a long time to forgive him. In fact, I'm not sure that she's completely forgiven him now. It all came to a head during a sketch about spies. At the end of Pieces of Eight, they had this James Bond sort of thing where they came on and Kenneth was in a tuxedo and she was in a ball gown, and they both had their gadgets to compare, and he would open his briefcase and show off all these James Bond knives and weaponry. And she would reveal that inside her sash there was a stiletto, and it got to the stage where they were comparing death pills. And Fenella insisted that hers were much more potent. And Kenneth said, "No, mine will kill you much quicker." And so they had a standoff. They both, 1, 2, 3, swallowed their cyanide pills and proceeded to go into paroxysms of agony, throwing themselves around on the floor, until at last Fenella would die, leaving Kenneth dying in the spotlight. And she would wriggle off in the darkness and go and change for the final big number, song and dance. Only one night, Kenneth wouldn't allow that to happen. And every time she started to fall down to die, he'd do something so that he pulled the spotlight onto her. And she couldn't die. And in the end, Fenella had to shout out, Last one dead's a city. And she dropped, boom, to the stage. Kenneth was livid. Backstage, he cornered her and said, "You insinuated to the entire audience that I am a homosexual." This was 1960, and it was illegal to indulge in things like that. Didn't stop Kenneth riding round on the back of a friend's Vespa. He liked to go around Piccadilly Circus, shouting out every time they passed the policeman, "Arrest me, officer! I am homosexual!" So he didn't mind saying it, but if somebody else called him a sissy on stage, he went straight to the producer and demanded that she should be sacked. The producer, Michael Corleone, stood up to him and made Kenneth apologise. All of this was laid out day by day in Kenneth's diaries, and he was so cross that the ink still sizzles. You can see it on the page. There's a sort of a steam coming off it. So yes, he could be a really villainous personality, but for all that, so lovable that his true friends cannot bring themselves to say anything against him, no matter how hurtful he might have been to them. There's an enormous depth of affection for him still, I think, in the country, among the public, people who remember those chat show appearances 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I like to think that the villainy was just seasoning, and that he's really, truly a hero of comedy.
That's a very nice way to put it, I must say, seasoning. And Chris, there's a nice North London connection to Kenneth too, isn't there? Because unlike the rest of the people we're talking about today, who range far and wide from their birthplaces, he tried very hard not to leave the sort of mile radius of St Pancras where he was first from. He didn't even really want to go to Hollywood. I mean, he did travel on holidays and for work, but he had no interest in living outside WC1, really, did he? And in fact, you describe with horrible vividness his early life in what were really slums behind St Pancras Station. And it's quite shocking to read some of those stories. I mean, you must have, I think that's something people don't necessarily know about him. They know he was working class, but not that he grew up in really nasty tenements.
Yes, he was born in a two-room apartment about half a mile behind St Pancras Station, what George Orwell called the vague brown slums of the proles. In 1984, that is where the proles live, and very much Kenneth's upbringing was not merely working class, but a desperate scrabble for survival. His father was born in a house which has now been demolished in Sydney Street, where nine families were crowded into this one house, leaking roof, rats everywhere. And it's understandable that Charlie Williams believed that more than anything, it was essential for a man to have a trade, something that he could fall back on. And nobody ever believed in Kenneth's family, even Kenneth himself didn't truly believe, that acting was a trade. He hadn't trained for it. There were no qualifications that came with it. There was no security with it. And it was a constant source of friction within his family. The night that Kenneth came out to his family, I don't think I've told this story before, it's in the book. The night that Kenneth came out, he had been at Basingstoke in Repertory Theatre. It was one of those jobs where it would pay money for a couple of weeks, and he barely had enough to cover his rent. He hated that situation, that he didn't have savings to fall back on. And his sister, who had been married to an Australian during the war, had just been divorced and had come home. That put a real strain on the family finances. His dad ran a little barber's shop in Marchmont Street, which is still a hairdresser's. And for Pat, the sister, to be sponging, as both Charlie and Kenneth saw it, was a situation that they couldn't put up with for very long, particularly as Pat wasn't Charlie's daughter. She had been born before Charlie met Louisa, the mother. Louis had been engaged in the early 20s and, shamefully for the time, became pregnant. And when her fiancé, Ted, found out that she was pregnant, even though the banns had been read and the church was booked, he dumped her. And Louis was left to bring up a girl on her own. In fact, I discovered while I was researching the book that Pat was born in the workhouse. That was something that Louis never even told Pat or Ken. It was a secret so black, I think Louis took it to the grave herself. You can work it out from Pat's birth certificate. And so there's all of this tension within the family. This older girl who's come back after having been married off, and Kenneth struggling to make a living, and it's still austerity years, rationing. And late at night, a family row blows up. And Kenneth is accused of having a career that has no legitimacy. And he seized on that word. And he looked at Pat and he said, well, if we're going to talk about legitimacy... And then it all came out. Every accusation that could be thrown around by anybody. And of course, Pat announced to his parents that she knew her brother was gay. And I'm not quite sure how we got onto that, but it's a... Yes, well, it's a pretty grimy, gritty glimpse of life around St Pancras Station just after the war. Alan Simpson.